portion of the docket now, and we have the case of Andrew Watkins versus Commonwealth of Virginia. Good morning. So that I do not butcher it, could you please help me with the pronunciation of your last name?
Sizek.
Sizek. Thank you. And Ms. Sizek, you may begin whenever you're ready. Good morning, Mr. Chandeville. Ms. Sizek, would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'll reserve 2 minutes. May it please the Court. I'm Linda Sizek, and I represent Mr. Watkins and his appeal from his conviction for involuntary manslaughter. First, let me say this is a tragic case. One man is dead, one man serving 5 years for what was described mainly as a drunken argument. While Mr. Watkins feels that there were other contributing factors to Mr. Bicker's ultimate death, I believe the main issue in this appeal is whether Mr. Watkins was acting in self-defense when he struck Mr. Bickers, knocking him over and causing him to hit his head.
Let me ask about that, Ms. Sizek. Self-defense is an affirmative defense, and the burden of persuasion is on your client. How do we as an appellate court substitute our judgment for that of the fact finder? Don't we have to make findings of fact in order to determine whether or not self-defense was proven or was sufficiently raised to at least raise a reasonable doubt?
Well, that is true, Your Honor. It is an affirmative defense, and whether the evidence is sufficient for reasonable doubt is a question of fact. And the judge must be either plainly wrong or find that there was no evidence to support it. However, when there are undisputed facts, self-defense can be
proved. Self-defense was certainly disputed here, wasn't it?
I think the judge may have had an issue with...
The Commonwealth never accepted self-defense, otherwise there wouldn't have been a prosecution.
But I think the issue is whether there was any facts to dispute self-defense. If there are no facts to dispute self-defense, the court can find that there was self-defense as a matter of law. And I think it boils down to the testimony of Mr. Watkins and Mr. Harris. As the Judge Franklin in this case said, he basically, Mr. Harris was the one that actually saw the second half of the argument. This went on for a while. There was Mr. Watkins would come out and go in. They were tussling, and I think the judge found the initial contacts more of a mutual combat. However, Mr. Watkins retreated inside the house and then came back outside to leave. He got into his car, and Mr. Bickers, the victim in the case, was out. He was trying to get Sarah Connors out, or Sarah out of the van, and then when she.
Well, we're familiar with the facts, but let me ask you this question: If in the abstract, if there's mutual combat, then your client has a duty to retreat. Now he has no duty to retreat in his own home, but he's not in his own home. He comes out of his home.
And attempts to leave.
But my point is that. Given the state of the law of self-defense when you've got mutual combatants, shouldn't he have stayed in his home? In other words, how do you avail yourself of self-defense if you have some fault in bringing on the problem when, clearly you retreat into your own home, which is fine, but then you come out again knowing the individual's still out there and confront him a second time. So why is it unreasonable for the court as a matter of law to reject self-defense as an affirmative defense in a circumstance like that?
Well, Your Honor, I think if you look at it as two separate incidents, which is I think how Judge Franklin had viewed the circumstance. He viewed it as the first one where they tussled, Mr. Watkins went back inside, and there was still fighting, arguing rather, going on between Mr. Bickers and Sarah. And essentially Mr. Watkins decided he had enough, he was going to leave. So he was actually attempting to
Which was
leave.
A mistake, apparently.
Well, in hindsight, that yes. But he attempted to leave. Mr. Bickers was standing in front of the his car, his van, and not allowing him to drive away. And if you look at what Mr. Harris said and what Mr. Watkins testified, the circuit court judge basically said that the two testimonies were essentially the same. The only difference is that Mr. Harris was fixated on the men and I guess the faces, what they were saying. He noticed that Mr. Bickers had, the victim had the bike in his hand. However, when questioned by me as to whether or not he was focusing on the bike or if he saw what Mr. Bickers had done with the bike, he said he wasn't focused on that. So we have fairly matching testimony between Mr. Watkins and Mr. Harris, except for the fact that Mr. Watkins, when he came out and told Mr. Bickers to leave, his testimony was Mr. Bickers was going to say, "What are you going to do about it?" and shove the bike up towards him, across his foot. Given the previous fight and given that he was making an aggressive move and it actually touched him, it was reasonable for Mr. Watkins to believe that he was about to be further assaulted by Mr. Bickers. I think that's where you...
Well, that may well be, but isn't that a determination for the fact finder?
Again, Your Honor...
I mean, you're making a great jury argument, but we're not a jury.
And I understand, Your Honor. I will leave it to you. I think the case law does say that, you know, it is a question of fact. However, it can be overturned when the judge is either plainly wrong or there is no evidence to the contrary. And again, there's no... Obviously, Mr. Harris was viewing this incident from 50 yards away. It was getting dark, and so what we have is more or less, unfortunately Mr. Biggers is not here to describe what he did, but we have the testimony of Mr. Watkins saying that he was assaulting him and he hit him in more or less self-defense. He felt like he was going to be attacked again based on everything that had happened previously. And there was no evidence to say that they specifically saw, you know, what Mr. Bickers did with the bike and that the incident that Mr. Watkins described did not happen. So, I understand that these issues are often an issue of fact for the judge to determine, but I will say that it's certainly possible for the Court of Appeals to find that there was no evidence to dispute Mr. Watkins' claim of self-defense. And if he did act in self-defense, then he was engaging in a lawful act, not an unlawful act. And then we move to the fact that...
Well, typically force used in self-defense has to be proportionate. In other words, you know, in this case, I guess the assault is the running over his foot with a bicycle tire. Is that right? Theoretically justified the deadly response. Is that correct?
Well, there was certainly earlier in the fight, Mr. Bickers had punched...
But you just described that as a completely separate incident.
And I understand that was a separate accident.
Both ways.
But again, what you're looking at, it's a subjective, whether or not, you know...
Which is exactly why it should go to the jury. I mean, it's exactly why it's not a question of law. When there's you know, issues of fact to be resolved, such as whether the force was justified or whether it was proportional and that sort of thing, that is quintessentially a jury question, isn't it?
I understand, Your Honor. This was a bench trial.
A question for the fact finder.
For the fact finder. But again, you know, there is case law that I cited in my petition and brief that does cases have allowed for the issue of self-defense to be determined or at least reviewed by an appellate court. And again,
but on your best day, the act that gives rise to your client's allegation of the provocation for self-defense was the rolling of the bike over the toe, correct?
That and his words saying, make me. He took an aggressive stance.
Well, words could never justify death.
Well, he took an aggressive attitude. Well, words plus the bike put my client in fear of additional touching. And I would say that when we look at the proportionality...
Well, getting back to my question first, the act that gives rise to the allegation that there's self-defense in here was the rolling of the bike over the toe, plus what you say is someone's aggressive stance and their words.
Correct.
We have Mr. Harris that testifies that he doesn't see any of that occur. We have the trial court that accepts Mr. Harris's testimony, deems him to be a credible witness. Doesn't that mean, by inference, that the trial court found that that event never occurred? And isn't that a natural inference if you accept Mr. Harris's testimony as opposed to what the trial court could have decided was the self-serving testimony of the defendant?
I believe that's what the trial court ruled in his opinion, yes, Your Honor.
So viewing the evidence or the facts in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, as we must, do not we have to conclude that the rolling of the bike over the foot never occurred?
Again, I still believe that given that there was no evidence to the contrary, again, Mr. Harris was not focused on the bicycle and what Mr. Vickers was doing with the bicycle. I would argue that this court could review it on the standard of whether or not the judge was plainly wrong in not considering the evidence of self-defense that was undisputed. Again, no one was focused.
Well, it's undisputed if you assume that Mr. Harris was in a position to see it but simply didn't see it, as opposed to it just not occurring.
But again, Your Honors, I did, in the transcripts, I specifically asked Mr. Harris, were you focused on what Mr. Vickers was doing with the bike, or were you just observing the two men? And he basically testified that he was not fixated on the bike. He knew the bike was there, but he was just watching the men argue. He said nothing about Mr. Vickers, anything he did with the bike. He just claimed that he had his hands on his bike, and he said he was not focused on it. So there was no evidence that Mr. Harris saw at all what Mr. Vickers did or didn't do.
But again, isn't there a natural inference that can be gleaned by the fact finder that the rolling over the toe with the bike just didn't happen? I mean, that's a permissible inference, isn't it?
It's an inference, yes, Your Honor.
Isn't it a permissible one?
It's a permissible one.
So where does that leave us?
Again, Your Honor, there is an issue of whether or not the fact that Mr. Watkins' statement, alone without any further evidence to the contrary, again, not being disputed, can be found to be self-defense as a matter of law if the judge was just plainly wrong or did not consider the evidence.
You are well into your rebuttal time at this point. Is there anything else you'd like to address now, or would you like to reserve the remaining
time? I'll reserve it, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Chandeville?
Good morning. May it please the Court. Chris Chandeville for the Commonwealth. As the Court has already alluded to in this case, in order for Mr. Watkins to prevail in this appeal, he would have to establish that the undisputed facts in this case proved as a matter of law he was reasonably responding in self-defense when he clothesline punched the victim in the face, causing the victim to fall backwards onto the pavement, crack his head open, and eventually bleed to death. There are no undisputed facts which would support that conclusion, and thus Mr. Watkins has failed to prove as a matter of law that he was acting in self-defense. Secondly, in order to prevail, Mr. Watkins would have to prove that as a matter of law, the victim's intoxication was the sole contributing factor and the sole cause of the victim's death. And again, first of all, that argument was not made to the trial court and thus was not preserved. And secondly, there are no undisputed facts establishing that Mr. Watkins did not contribute to the victim's death when he punched him in the face, causing him to fall and crack his head open on the pavement, but that the victim's intoxication caused that by itself. And because on appeal, Mr. Watkins has failed to prove and cannot prove either of those as a matter of law, his convictions should be affirmed in this case. That's the only result that flows from the evidence that was introduced at trial. For those reasons, we would ask this court to affirm his convictions, and unless there are any questions for the Commonwealth, I'm more than happy to rest in my brief.
No questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chandler.
Your Honors, as to the part of the appeal addressing the causation of the injuries to Mr. Bickers, I think that goes to more to the issue of if you find that Mr. Watkins acted in self-defense and thus was engaged in a lawful act, whether or not that lawful act was done improperly, and that goes to whether or not his act in punching him in the jaw was a willful and wanton disregard for human life or essentially criminal negligence. And I think there's plenty of evidence that Mr. Bickers sustained injuries that, according to the coroner, could have been happened at up to a week, if not more, prior to this incident. The issue of his blood alcohol level also points out that the blood alcohol level contributed to the fact that he bled out. Had Mr. Bickers not been as intoxicated, the actions of Mr. Watkins may not have had the same result. So I think that the act of Mr. Watkins, if it was a lawful act of self-defense, did not rise to the level of any kind of gross or wanton disregard for human life. I think there were contributing factors that resulted in Mr. Bickers' death. So I would ask the court to dismiss his conviction.
Thank you very much. In keeping with custom of the court, we'll come down and greet counsel.
Call rise, please.
Good to see you too.
It's the court down there.
Yes, exactly.